I think one of the stories that really sort of struck me and surprised me and has unsurprisingly also resonated with a number of readers of this research is the story of the first generation of migrants, or the first generation of culturally and linguistically diverse communities, because they might really be thought of as accidental environmentalists, because they're not using the, as I said, the environmental terminology, but they're doing things which really have a positive impact on the environment. And these are people who often come from a background where they needed to be thrifty, you know, whether it was because they came from a refugee background or they came from a context in the global south where they were already kind of you know, conserving energy or repurposing old goods or recycling in some form or the other. Some of the stories did really surprise people because they didn't use that environmental framework for things that their mothers or grandmothers were doing. That's been a really interesting kind of observation that's emerged from this research.
Welcome to Understory, this 7th day of April 2021. I'm Elizabeth Poe. For the last few weeks, we have been going behind the scenes of the Extinction Rebellion movement. But today, Understory seeks to connect with those not so obviously engaged, front and centre, with environmental and social change issues, those from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. Understory looks at research which is starting to discover that from veggie gardening to op shopping, migrants may be the quiet environmentalists. Understory's Adrienne Glamorgan reports.
So my name is Sukhmani Khurana. I'm a senior research fellow at the Young and Resilient Research Centre, which is based at Western Sydney University.
Sukhmani Khurana, have you thought about the media depictions of people from different cultures in Australia, especially with that crossover with the environment? How are we doing in terms of a fair share of who Australians really are and our engagement with the natural world?
That's a great question. So my original background is in media research, media and migration. So I have my eyes always peeled to see, you know, how migrants are being represented in the media in different spheres. And as I mentioned, in the environmental movement, you know, whether you look at the climate change rallies or whether you look at Extinction Rebellion, you don't see non-white faces. And there could be a number of reasons for that. You know, there's previous research that indicates, as you mentioned, first generation migrants don't have the time. Some people are already engaged with environmental practices but don't see themselves reflected in the organized environmental movement, so they don't go to these protests. So it's a problem of perception as well. But having said that, I recently read an ABC story about a young student in Melbourne. I think she's about 16, and she comes from an Indian background who's been quite involved in the climate change rallies. And you know, her parents come from an agricultural background, and that's something we noticed as well in our second generation migrants, where, you know, an influence like that from their parents had an impact on what they were doing. So you do see stories like that, and a number of those people are sort of putting themselves and putting their faces out there. And I think the more young people see that, young people of diverse backgrounds see themselves reflected, the more they're likely to kind of feel that they will be welcomed in the environmental organizations. But at the same time, I think the environmental organizations could also do more to widen their perspectives, to also kind of think about the philosophies underpinning their approaches to the environment, to make it so that it's about global justice and not just about saving the reef. Saving the reef is very important, of course. I'm not discounting that, but I think a global approach is really, really important, especially when we're talking about an issue like climate change.
And your research showed a slight shift in terms of second generation migrants being a change agent between first generation migrants and a wider culture?
Yes, I think there is a lot of research more broadly that indicates the second generation acts as a kind of translator between the first generation and the broader community. But we found that in this case as well, the first generation, while they were doing things in their houses, in their own homes, weren't necessarily engaged in an outward sort of fashion. The second generation, there's a slight increase in that. They might not be involved in environmental politics, so they might not be going to protests, but they are sort of signing petitions online. But I think the biggest change is that they're talking. They're talking to their own children, if they've got children. They're talking to their peers, to their colleagues, to their friends. And that is quite a significant shift.
First and second generation migrants appear to be underrepresented in the urban environment movement, but they may still be contributing in important ways to sustainability at home within frameworks not usually recognised as being environmental, and yet they may have much to teach us.
I had this particular story wasn't mentioned in the report, but there was this young gentleman, I think he was from an Indian background, first generation migrant living sort of in the urban fringes of Sydney. He was increasingly becoming interested in the Australian environment and sustainability practices. You know, they had sort of rainwater tanks in their house and solar panels, and had started talking to their neighbors about also doing similar things, often having those conversations from the point of view of saving energy and saving costs. But what really struck me was a story of how he felt when during the bushfires. This is someone who's not athletic, doesn't consider himself athletic, but he literally went to the local bushfire service and said he wanted to enroll himself as a volunteer. So that was how much he felt impacted by what was taking place. Of course, he couldn't go ahead with it because he had previous physical injuries that prevented him from being a full-fledged bushfire. But that kind of sentiment amongst first-generation migrants really resonated and made me realize that there are at least pockets of populations where and there is a very high degree of interest in not just the environment, but also investment in the Australian environment. There is so much more we could do to leverage stories of that kind.
From earliest European arrivals here in Western Australia, the colony and then the federated state has depended on migration. After Sydney and Melbourne, it's Perth which comes in at third spot on the list of Australian cities with the highest number of overseas-born population, with our more than 700,000 migrants. And in the 2016 census, it was Western Australia, out of all the states, which had the largest population of overseas-born individuals. Given such a key presence amongst us, it would seem important for green groups to find ways to ensure their participation and contribution is enabled and recognised.
So one of the stories was of a second generation Vietnamese woman who's currently a university student, and she described what her mother used to do when she first arrived in Australia. Although she had, degrees in Vietnam, she couldn't really find work in Australia that sort of gave her a lot of money. So she used to, again, repurpose a number of goods. They never had any kind of plastic in their house. They used to sew old clothes. And when her mother was finally able to afford a house, she had planted her own community garden instead of sort of running to the grocery store to buy vegetables. So this was almost sort of accidental environmentalism for her generation, the mother's generation, but the daughter was talking about how it's had an impact on her. So the daughter may not have a material need to carry on these practices, but nonetheless, she's doing that. And she's also quite significantly trying to sort of spread the message to her peers who may be, from these diverse communities or who may be sort of Anglo-Australians. She's quite involved with the number of land care projects, a number of volunteering projects in her community. She's also involved with university clubs to do with sustainability. So she's almost kind of taken what her mother used to do understood that as good for the environment and kind of is carrying that forward. So that's a really fantastic story.
25 years ago, it was very hard to talk to environmental campaigners about working with trade unions. It seems to be a little bit more happening now, I guess. But what sort of groups do you think environmental campaigners should be approaching to listen to as well as to campaign with?
I think it really, the environment is really something that sort of is impacting everyone. So there is really no limit to the kind of a number of groups they could be consulting with. As I mentioned before, businesses, small and large businesses, some of them are already doing a lot, and that's often not reflected in the wider conversation. But a number of small businesses are owned by people from diverse backgrounds, and that could be a point of engagement which environmental organizations haven't tapped into thus far. I've been talking to councils, and councils say that faith-based organizations are also places where a lot of people gather for various reasons, for social reasons. And that's a point where environmental organizations could also do a bit of, you know, outreach. So the sky is the limit, but I think starting with those sorts of organizations, that could be good. So I guess it's almost a two-pronged approach that's required. A number of local councils in New South Wales, and I guess across Australia, feel that they struggle to communicate with these diverse communities. That's because of language and other kinds of barriers. So they already have fantastic sustainability initiatives, but they're not necessarily reaching the target communities. And at the same time, these first-generation migrants, either they're not engaged with their local community organizations, you know, like especially local government, or if they are engaged, they are not, say, confident enough to speak up at council meetings, is one of the findings that emerged from our study. So it almost needs to be a case of, you know, local government finding these people who are doing things and meeting them where they are, as well as these groups having some sort of capacity building or training for them to be able to contribute to whatever sustainability initiatives are taking place in local government, you know, to be able to say what you're doing with regards to, say, saving water is great, but this is what I do in my own home, or this is what I used to do back home in my own country when it was a really hot day. And perhaps that is something that could also help other people in Australia.
Can we extend that out to the question of the climate emergency? What sort of sensitivity or interest did you come across in your research for the broader question about how we manage the environment as a community?
I guess this is where the level of political activity wasn't as high as it may be, say, amongst a number of your listeners who are already involved in the organized environmental movement. So some of the participants, especially the second generation participants who, you know, say came from a background in the humanities, were critical of, say, Australian government policies which weren't doing enough. But by and large, I don't think there was a very high degree of awareness. Where I think more work could be done is that a number of these people, say, worked in positions in corporate positions, and they noticed that changes were taking place. So if someone was working at Big W, then they noticed that Big W was starting to invest in organic cotton. So they may be less aware of what's happening in terms of national policy, but there were other ways that they sort of try to compensate for that knowledge.
I just wonder whether or not there is something under the radar that's happening quietly.
Yes, there's a lot of work happening under the radar, which, you know, researchers and local councils and sort of, you know, state and federal governments are gradually becoming aware of. So instead of sort of a top-down model where people who are designing policies assume that people from diverse backgrounds are deficient they don't know how to adapt to a different climate, adapt to urban heat, and just sort of tell them how to cope with it. I think, again, has to be a bit of both, has to be a bit of translating what's already here and also learning from them and kind of trying to spread that information.
Dr. Sukhmani Khorana, Senior Research Fellow at the Western Sydney University. Her findings may be important for Western Australian environment groups keen to engage with the wider community.
Did some people suddenly look in the mirror and realise they might be environmentalists after all?
Yes, I think that's certainly happening. And I said, as people having a greater appreciation for frugality, maybe COVID's had an impact on that as well. People across different age groups and cultural backgrounds have started growing things in their houses because of, you know, lack of access or because of the availability of time. It was more a case of there was a perception that the environmental movement was not for them. This is including second generation migrants. So there is a story of a second generation migrant from China who is quite invested in environmental practices, does the right thing in his own place, talks to peers, and so on and so forth. But doesn't want to be seen as being politically involved. So being part of an organization, say, for instance, off the top of my head, Greenpeace would be being political. And I think from because of the sort of influence they've had from their parents' generation, being political is still stigmatized amongst some migrant communities. So I have to emphasize that it's not just a case of the environmental organizations kind of not including people from diverse individuals. I think there is a little bit of that, but it's also a number of people not kind of becoming part of these organizations for fear of, you know, what that might mean in their community or what that might mean for their citizenship or their residency. So some people do model what might be called model minority behavior. And certain other people are just time poor and perceive these organizations as outside of their area of interest.
Have you been changed by your research in any way?
Well, as it happens, I had a child in the course of doing this research, and I think it's only emphasized to me the intergenerational aspects of, you know, carrying certain things forward, but also making sure that you do your best for the next generation. So the stories of, you know, the first generation Vietnamese migrant and her daughter were a really big surprise for me, because it made me think about my own mother and her passing on steel containers to me instead of, you know, plastic containers from takeaway shops. And it's made me rethink some of those practices and appreciate them more. And hopefully I can pass them on to my own daughter.
Dr. Sukhmani Khorana and Claudia Serdar's February 2021 report entitled Young Australian Migrants and Environmental Values, How and Why Do Certain Migrants Practice Care? Was published by Western Sydney University and is available as a document online. Thanks to Adrienne Glamorgan for this week's program, and to you for joining us each week. I'm Elizabeth Poe, and you can find and share our past programs online at the RTRFM website, as well as podcasts wherever you like to harvest them. And we'll be back next week, same time, same planet, as there's always more to explore with Understory, radio for the planet.